Hi there. Welcome to Season 2 of the Sales for Founders podcast. I'm your host, Louis Nichols, and every Wednesday I sit down with successful founders and sales and marketing experts to bring you actionable advice on how to learn sales, find your first customers, and grow a profitable business. This week I am super excited to be chatting with Rob Fitzpatrick, author of The Mum Test, and we're going to go deep on a subject that a lot of founders, especially beginner founders, struggle with, talking to customers. Now, I've wanted to have Rob on the show for quite a while now, and I'm really excited that we've managed to get him here today. Rob has been an entrepreneur for over 12 years. He went through Y Combinator. He's raised funding in the US and the UK. He's built products used by customers like Sony and MTV. He's even designed and kickstarted a card game. And now he lives in Barcelona and writes books, including The Mum Test, which we're going to talk a lot about today. Rob, it is amazing to have you here. Why don't you kick us off by giving us a bit of the background around how The Mum Test came to be?
Hey, so I'm Rob Fitzpatrick. I wrote a book called The Mum Test, which is about how to ask better questions in your customer conversations, get good learnings, avoid the biases, and then hopefully transition that into sales if all goes well. And this came out of my experiences going through YC as a technical founder and being forced into a sales role way back in 2007. I hated the transition into sales, but I kind of felt like I needed to do it. And I was trying to follow Steve Blank and the customer development. And, you know, Paul Graham was telling us to go talk to customers. And it was a big slap in the face to learn that just talking to them isn't enough. You have to ask the right kind of questions in the right way. Otherwise, you can really lie to yourself with huge amounts of unreliable and misleading data. So once I eventually figured it out, that company sadly failed. We were very upset because we worked so hard and we suffered and it didn't work anyway. And then I realized my personality is much more in the bootstrapped and lifestyle world. So that first one was the only proper scalable startup I did. And since then, I've been bootstrapping, working with friends, having a great time. I eventually figured out how to ask the customer questions better. And that's what's written up in The Mum Test.
Awesome. And how do you spend your days now?
At the moment, I got a team of three. It's myself, my best friend who's based in London. I'm in Barcelona and my girlfriend's on the team as well. And we're basically building tech and processes for a little publishing business. So we realized like books are a good product category. I enjoy writing. And so instead of making software, we're basically, you know, software to sell. We're making software around the publishing process so that we can sell books more effectively. And in the end, I'm hoping that some of those will spin out into standalone products because we're making some cool stuff that saves a ton of time.
Awesome. Do you want to dive into that a bit more, how it works, or is it still under wraps?
Well, so the business itself, like books are a cool product category compared to tech. So like you make tech and then you're on the rope forever, like doing support and server maintenance and all this stuff. It never ends. I realized like books, like they're truly hands off. And I was really motivated for a good few years to find a product that would work as proper passive income. And I think it was Amy Hoy who said, passive income isn't, like it isn't passive because you're always doing customer support. You're always doing maintenance. And I found in books, I was like, this is the holy grail I've been looking for because it's truly passive. And I realized that instead of using my tech skills to build the product I was selling, I could use my tech skills to make the business processes more efficient. And so where other small publishers use a ton of like interns and people and all of that, we've been able to just like string together really simple bits of tech to automate almost everything we do. So it's a super hands-off, super profitable little business. It takes care of the three of us. It's a good lifestyle.
That sounds really interesting. I'd love to dig into that more at some point, but I want to come back to something you said there about the passive income, which is, I think really true. I love that quote. It sounds a lot like something that Amy would have said, which is, I guess you're in a similar position to me in that, I mean, I've started a SaaS company, funded one, a bootstrapped one. I've done an info product now with the course. I've done an e-commerce business, a services business. I've done some consulting. And it does seem to me that kind of those info producty things do seem to be the closest to what I suppose you could call passive income. But at the same time, what I've seen is that with the Mum Test, I mean, you've really kind of hit the nail on the head with the passive side of stuff there. I mean, you don't do a large amount of marketing for that at all.
Yeah, I have no mailing list. I haven't written a blog post in years. There was no like launch event or speaker tour. Like, yeah, it's just been like my whole thesis was that if you solve a sharp problem with the book and if the book does it well, and I knew the book would work because I taught it a lot first. And I feel like teaching is the MVP of a business book. Like you teach and you coach and you figure out how to move people through that process. So many people, I think they write their books and they've never actually helped anyone to do what the book is trying to help people do. And that's like going back to waterfall software development. You know, it's like building without being in contact with users. It's crazy. Your book's guaranteed not to work if you build it that way. So I think you need some way of like, you know, like you start with teaching, you start with coaching, you start with helping your friends out. And then eventually, if you find something that really works, you can solidify it into a book. And yeah, so I was pretty confident it would work. I didn't know if anyone would want it, but thankfully it turns out that that they do.
Sure. So, I mean, I remember I kind of found, I think, on Hacker News a few years back now when I was kind of in the early stages of a funded business I was growing. And then didn't hear about it for a while. I became disillusioned with kind of the VC stuff. I'd moved into bootstrapping. I was more on indie hackers and stuff like that. And all of a sudden, the Mumtest was everywhere. So it was a real slow burner. And I think you almost did that on like you built the book, as I understand it, to kind of be able to achieve that on purpose. And I'd love to hear a couple of words about how you did that, because I think that could be really useful for people out there who are thinking about similar kinds of products.
Well, I tried not to date it. So I tried not to like attach it too explicitly to any of the current trends. Like lean was really huge at the time. And I tried to like not make it the lean start. Like a lot of my early readers, they're like, oh, you should call this lean conversations. And I kind of didn't want to because I thought it would sell more in the short term. But then, you know, I'd be betting on someone else's horse.
Right.
And so I was like, okay. And then the other thing I did, which was really helpful, was I was like, okay, this is specifically for like introverted tech entrepreneurs like me. And that meant I could skip a lot of introductory knowledge. So the book doesn't start with like, let me explain why you should talk to customers. So like practically the first words of the book are like, if you want to talk to customers, I will tell you how to do it properly. And I felt like that knowing who it was for, and you can apply this to any product. If you make the hard choice about who it's not for and who it is for, then you can leave a ton of stuff out. And that lets you save months of development because you don't need to build all those extra features for that extra customer segment. Your language can be so much sharper. Your marketing material can be so much sharper because you know exactly who you're speaking to. You know their worldview. You know what they already know. And founders really flinch away from this because they go, no, I don't want to lose business. I don't want to exclude any potential customers. But if you try to include everyone, you just end up with zero because you're like lukewarm for everyone. It's much better to be like super sharp for a specific type of person. And once you've locked that in, you can expand out from there, which the book has done. It's like jumped into product management and a few other places. But like taking a hard stand, introverted tech founders, that's who it's for. It's like, okay, everything's very focused on that. And then not anchoring to trends was part of it. And then I just wanted it to be very recommendable. Like the reason I was willing to choose such a stupid title was because I didn't expect anyone to find it and buy it. I expected it to always be recommended. Someone's like, oh man, I'm having a nightmare time with my customer conversations. And someone else is like, ah, I know the solution. It's this book. So I really tried to build it as like a problem solver word of mouth book. And yeah, that's paid off. And if you look at the growth, it's just like a line up and to the right. It's pretty steadily growing over the last 6 years. It's been nice.
Brilliant. Yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of it. I go even further than recommending it. I actually make people in the course sit down and read it, and I won't answer any questions that I know are answered in the book. It's brilliant to have that there to be able to refer back to. And what part of what I want to do today in our conversation is to look at some of the questions that founders, technical founders mainly, come to me with around growing from maybe they have an idea, maybe they don't have one yet, up to the first 50 or 100 customers.
Perfect, let's do it.
Great. And one of the big ones that is sort of covered in the book, but you don't go into a lot of detail about it specifically, I don't think, is how you should approach doing this kind of customer development, customer discovery process when you don't have an idea at all, when you're kind of trying to find an idea.
So I really like Paul Graham's view on this. He wrote a great article, and he was basically saying like too many kids in university or people in university are like, they're a bit too overeager. So they like drop out of university or they're like, we need to start a startup right now. And he says that this leads to sitcom startup ideas, like the sort of idea that they would come up on with on Friends if like Joey wanted to start a startup. You know, it's like, oh, well, who do we know? Students. What do students do? They drink. Okay, so we'll make a couponing app to help students drink. It like sounds like a startup, but it's like a very easy type of idea to have. And PG says like the best ideas come from living your life. Like go out, get an interesting job, or like pursue interesting hobbies, or like learn interesting technology, because you need that foundation of understanding of some part of the world. And it can come from a variety of places. Like he says, one is to be on the cutting edge of a new technology, because then you'll see the applications faster than other people. So he's like, if you love tech, just like throw yourself into whatever it is, virtual reality, machine learning, computer vision. And it's like, you'll start spotting the opportunities. Another way is to engage with the type of people you care about. Like, I really care about teachers. I like the active teaching. I like to support teachers. I find teachers interesting to talk to. So I spent a lot of time just like hanging out with university professors, and pretty quickly I was full of ideas about ways to make their lives better. And then you go, okay, like I want something that can make their life better, but which can also pay my bills and build a company. So I'm looking for that intersection of things that could make their life better that they also have budget for. But like hobbies are another one. Like if you're deeply engaged in a hobby, you start to, that's like a niche, a customer base. Like for poker players, for people who love a certain video game, there's like great businesses being built. Just like there's so many tools for entrepreneurs, there's like tools for like the passionate fans of these games or any other hobby. So I'd say as much as possible, like don't do your idea creation in a boardroom. Do it by like living your life and doing interesting things and just running this background process of like, what does this person need help with? Or what would fans of this hobby or people, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I kind of see it a bit like I guess trying to find a partner. You can sit around on a dating app, kind of swiping left and right on people you think are perfect, but there's no guarantee they'll swipe back. Or you can just kind of be the kind of person who they would find interesting and go and hang out in the kind of places that they would be hanging out at. And eventually you'll meet the right person, hopefully. But
absolutely. One of my favorite idea origin stories, I talked to a dude at like a London startup event, and he's like, what's your business? He's like, it's like eBay for fruit. I was like, oh man, this is the worst business I've ever heard. You know, what, like oranges and cherries? And he's like, yeah, exactly. And I was like, oh, this guy's killing me. But he was a cool dude. We were chatting for a bit, and it turns out he'd been working on the dockyards for like 10 years, where large shipping containers full of fruit arrive. Mm-hmm. And a decent proportion of the fruit has been like bought, you know, and pre-allocated, and it goes out to the grocery stores. But you never know how many cherries are going to come in a harvest. So there'll be, you know, X hundred tons that are kind of left over, and it just gets auctioned off live at 4 a.m, like a fish market or something. And he's like, yeah, the industry's really suffering. It's terribly inefficient. A ton of stuff gets thrown out. And it was like, honestly, the easiest success I'd ever seen from an entrepreneur. He's just like, yeah, the industry needs it. No one's building it. I'm going to build it. I understand the industry. I know the people. Boom, boom, boom. Like by the end of like, once I learned about how anchored he was in that world, I'm like, wow, this is an incredible idea. You know, I did a complete 180. And it's the sort of idea he's never going to have competition for, because it's so unique to his life and his experiences. And it just was immediately profitable, immediately growing super fast. And it was a huge success just because like he had that life experience that no one else had.
Yeah, I love that example. And I want to kind of put you on the spot a bit there, because so maybe this example is, you know, maybe that idea was kind of super obvious, but at the same time, he was working with a lot of people, presumably, who had the same access to information, you know, was seeing the same things as he was, but they didn't come up with this idea. So there must be something kind of, exactly. There must be something more to it than just being in the right place at the right time. So
yeah, I'd completely agree. It's like, it's this scanning process. You're like, what's wrong here? What would be better? And you have to know enough about technology. Like someone who doesn't know how to make a website is just not going to see that type of idea. Whereas if you're versed in the technology, and the more technologies you're versed in, the more ideas become visible to you. And also, if you get good at talking to people about their lives, and this is something I've learned kind of during and since writing the Mom Test, I'm now in the habit of when I talk to people, I'm like, oh, that sounds tough. Tell me more about that. Just like anything about their life. And I find it makes me a better conversationalist because people love talking about their problems. But I'm also constantly discovering like where these little frustrations are. They'll mention something about their work and I'll go, wow, that must cost the company millions of dollars. And they'll just tell me about it. And I'm kind of filing that away for later. Occasionally I'll write them down if they're inside my wheelhouse, but mostly it's just this background process that runs. It's just like scanning for ideas, scanning for applications.
Sure. So what do you think someone should do? Let's say they're in that situation where they've, they've put themselves in a super interesting place. They're talking to interesting people. They seem to have noticed some kind of pain or problem. What should they be doing next? You know, how do they go from there to actually having some kind of product idea that someone seems interested in buying?
I would look at what these people are already doing and why they're doing it that way and what else they searched for or tried before settling on the way they're currently doing it. For example, they might say, oh yeah, we just use Excel and Post-it notes. And you're like, as a technologist, you're like horrified. You're like, wow, Excel and Post-it notes, these people are cavemen. But then you talk to them and they're like, yeah, we tried all the tech and the tools and they had these problems. Like, honestly, the Post-it notes are great. We all share an office. We're a single team. It's really easy. And then you're like, ooh, well, what about customers like this who aren't a single team and who don't share an office? And so suddenly, like, by kind of understanding what they're already doing and why they're doing it that way, you start to get a lot of insight, both about like what they're looking for in a solution, and also a clearer view on exactly who your customer segment is. Because customer segments always start out way too broad. You're like, my customer segment is universities. But it turns out there's a huge difference between top-tier universities and mid-tier universities. They have different budgets, different goals, different risks, different priorities. And so when we start a business, we think universities, I'm serving universities. And it's only through starting to engage with them that you go, ah, no, I'm serving upper mid-tier universities who aspire to be upper tier, you know? So like they have a large discretionary budget to try to emulate the best practices of the top universities. And suddenly you're like, ah, I know exactly which 10 universities I need to go talk to. And when you talk to them, instead of being turned away, they're like, yeah, we need to talk to you. This is an important thing for us. And this is part of why I don't really worry about conversion rates or response rates early on in the process. Because if you talk to 100 people and like 95 of them hate you, that doesn't really mean anything except that they're probably not the customers. And who are these five who don't hate you? Like, what don't they not, like, what do they like about it? Like, you're sort of trying to navigate in to find both the problem that's important to them and also the customers who really care. So you don't go like, oh, I only got a 5% conversion on my meetings or whatever. You go, no. I found five of the right type of customers. That's great. And then that lets you get deeper in the right direction.
Right. Yeah. I want to go back to something quickly there about the Excel point while it's fresh in my mind, which is just that I'm sure you'll agree as well that obviously people's, you know, an employee's personal goals and the company's goals can be very different. And while an Excel may seem a horrible way of doing things for the business to you or I, if you're the person at the company who knows how to work that Excel spreadsheet, then you're basically irreplaceable. So it can be if you can become the person who knows how to work the Excel spreadsheet at your business, then become that person. It has advantages.
Yeah. If your clients are businesses or enterprises or governments or universities or anyone with lots of teams and politics, it becomes really important to start doing stakeholder mapping early in the process, which basically means you're trying to figure out all the people within their company who could prevent them from using your thing. Because, for example, in the Excel case, like you say, there's going to be one person who knows the Excel sheet. And if you're replacing it, even if it's better for everyone else, it's a risk for this one person. And so they're going to be working fairly actively behind the scenes to prevent their team from buying your technology. So you need to kind of know they exist, know they object, and then like explicitly like bring them over to your side by spending extra time with them or find a way to get their boss to overrule them, which is obviously very like risky and politically volatile way to approach things. But if it's like an important early type of currency, if you're talking to a business and they seem like, yeah, this is awesome. I would love to have something like this. This is incredible. This is such a big problem. We desperately need to solve it. The important question that you want to ask early on is like, okay, so like say I had something, who else on your team would need to approve this for you guys to start using it? And if they won't tell you, they're like, oh, I don't know, a few people. I'm not really sure. That's a sign that they don't actually really care. But if they're willing to open the kimono and start naming names, be like, oh, you're going to need to talk to my CTO, our lawyers, our head of engineering. Just the fact that they're giving you that behind the scenes access, one, it makes your job so much easier, but two, it proves that they really, really care. And you need that, like, because that's how you start sorting your leads. You don't want to be wasting your time talking to 10 people who kind of care. You want to find the three people who really care and are likely to become your first customer, because then once you got that first one, everyone else can start to fall like dominoes. But the people who are kind of lukewarm, they're just not going to be risky enough to be your first customer. They want it to be a bit more proven. So you have to rank that pipeline and asking, doing the stakeholder mapping is one way you can do it.
Yeah, I really like that. Something I'd add on to that as well is just that a lot of times if you're selling to a bigger company, there's a good chance that the person you're selling to has never bought anything before for the company. So they have no idea who you need to talk to. So it's worth, you know, working out if they even know kind of, you know, how that sale will be made. There's a good chance they won't.
And if not, you can put them in the bucket of like optimistic supporter, but probably not first customer. And, you know, come back to them once you've figured out your lessons learned with someone who's much friendlier and more knowledgeable.
Exactly. So let's say I have someone who is a good, first kind of inside advocate, whatever you want to call them. I have a product that seems promising. I've kind of mapped out roughly the decision-making process and what it's going to take to get from here to closing a deal. How do I go about making that first sale what kind of things are, in your experience, of founders getting wrong about doing that?
So if it's consumers, you basically just ask them to pay you and sure. They either do or they don't. So that's pretty straightforward. If it is businesses, it's a little bit more subtle. And it depends on the price point and the discretionary budgets and whether or not one person can make the decision or whether the whole team has to make the decision. If one person can make the decision and they have a discretionary budget, it basically acts the same way as a consumer sale, where you're like, hey, do you want this? And they're like, yeah. And you're like, cool, it's this much money. And like, they pay you or they don't. And in some cases, you can learn a little more. They're like, but like, that's the normal proposal negotiation cycle. So the way this works is like, you talk to them, you try to understand what they need and want. You typically, if you're an inexperienced negotiator, you don't want to be negotiating live because you will get whipped because they're professional negotiators and you're an enthusiastic amateur. So what you want to do is you use your time in the meeting to learn as much as you can. Then you go away and you write down what you've learned as a proposal. You're like, okay, I think this is what you care about. I think this is what you need and it's going to cost this much. You send them the proposal and the negotiation happens through the proposal. So they'll look at it and they'll go, this doesn't work for me. And they'll either mark it up or you'll have a call. And again, you're learning what didn't work about the proposal. Then you go, great, let me update you and come back, or let me update the proposal and come back to you. And what this loop allows you to do is like to make your decisions about what you're offering and the price point and the deal terms and all of that outside of the heat and the time pressure of the meeting itself. And you can also talk to your team and you can talk to advisors and get more brains on the problem. So I would recommend that. That's what I think of as de-escalating with a proposal. So like first understand them. If they're interested, then you go into this proposal loop. If there's a bunch of people on their team, so multiple stakeholders, or heaven forbid, they're going to send you to legal and procurement, which is just a nightmare, which typically only happens in deals over like 10 or 20 grand. But if that's happening, then the whole playbook's different. So what happens there is you're basically looking for an early evangelist, which is the person who is going to fight for your product to be bought even after you're not in the room. So you basically convince one person who's an enthusiastic supporter. They adore you. They desperately want what you've got. Then you leave and they convince the rest of their team. And without this person, you're just not getting your first sale if it's a multi-stakeholder situation, because you leave the room, they forget about you. They go, isn't it kind of risky? They don't have any case studies yet. And everyone goes, yeah, we'll come back to that in 6 months. So you need this person who's fighting for you. So your whole job, if you're selling like bigger contracts, is to search for these internal evangelists, these early evangelists, and bring them around to your side of the table. And then you just ask them, you go, okay, you're on my team now. Like, how do we convince your company to buy this thing? And they will literally co-write the proposal with you because they want to succeed in selling it to their company as much as you do.
Sure. That's really good advice. And if you're listening to this and you are selling to those bigger companies, I really recommend you go back earlier in the podcast episodes and listen to one with Stephanie Hurlburt, who is selling, you know, 6- and 7-figure contracts to big tech companies and has made all the painful mistakes that you're going to make and can tell you how to avoid them. something I'd love to get into though is we've just been talking about obviously how to close that first sale. And we've kind of skipped over from, okay, I have a product and someone to sell it to, and I'm trying to close the deal. Well, how do I know as a founder how much I should be charging?
You basically make a number up and you keep doubling it if people keep buying it, but be very reluctant to reduce your price because normally if people aren't buying it, it's not because you're too expensive. It's because you're not solving an important enough problem. So you can double up, but don't double down usually. And you get your starting number by just benchmarking against the industry standard. And if there's no industry standard, you either make something up or you try to find a non-customer who is an industry expert. So you basically look through LinkedIn or you look through your network or you look through your investor's network or your university professor's network for people who are very senior in the industry and have recently retired, or for journalists who do a lot of writing about the industry, or for entrepreneurs who used to sell to this industry but have since sold their company or shut down. Because all of these people will understand the budgets and the approximate value of this problem, but they don't have a horse in the race. They don't feel like they need to be defensive. So if you can find one of these people who likes you for whatever reason, maybe you went to the same university, maybe a mutual friend introduced you, maybe your opening email is just incredible, whatever it is, like, they're not a customer, but they have all the information you need. So you basically just like put it all on the table and you're like, thank you so much. You can help me out so much with a little bit of guidance. Like, this is where we're at. This is what we're thinking. We don't know how to put a number on the sale. We don't know how to approach the sale. Like, what would you do if you were in my shoes? And like, boom, there's just going to be this waterfall of learning. And that'll help you skip a lot of iterations of mistakes and optimizations. It's not always possible, but it's a gold mine if you can find someone like that. And then you can keep using them throughout the life of your business. If I find a good one who I like, I often just give them 0.5% of equity or 1% of equity in return for their industry expertise. It's a really good deal to keep them on your side forever.
Interesting idea. I like that. And so what type, like when in kind of, you know, the founder's journey, if you want to call it that, when should they start thinking about pricing? Because a big problem that I see founders having is that they, you know, they get really excited about the problem they're solving, the idea, and they start building something out. And too late, they realize that, you know, this takes quite a lot of effort to sell. It's, you know, the cost of acquisition is pretty high and they can charge maybe $20 a month, which is obviously not a position you want to get to kind of 3 months, 6 months down the line. Right. So, you know, when can you start kind of testing that out? What's the right time to think about that, do you think?
I mean, you should probably have a sense of your like order of magnitude of pricing fairly early. But I don't worry too much about optimizing my early sales. For me, my first few sales are essentially binary. It's either worth nothing or it's worth something to the customers. And I'm really scared that I'm building something which is worth nothing. And so if I can get like the friction between like paying anything and not paying anything is like huge. So that's my like main priority. It's just like, can I get them to pay me something? And of course, I'm going to ask like in the approximate ballpark, but if I've got software that I'm planning to charge $2,000 for and someone can give me $500 because it's in their discretionary budget, I'm like, fine. Like I got 500. That's like not zero. Like, you know, I'm kind of on the right track. And then I'm not the world's best salesperson. I consider it my job to prove that the opportunity exists, that the problem exists, that the customers will pay, that the product kind of works. I'm like the prototyper of both the product and the sales. And if it's working well, then I'll bring in experts, either expert coaches to help me do it better or expert salespeople once I've like proven that people want to buy it and I know why they want to buy it. So I wouldn't worry about getting exact pricing, but yeah, you definitely want to make sure that like within the order of magnitude you're thinking is plausible. And don't keep dropping. Like if they don't buy it for 200, it's tempting to be like, okay, let me make it 50. Oh, they're still not buying. Let me make it 20. They're still not buying. It's like, if they won't buy it for 200, like the problem is more foundational. It's like, oh wait, I've either got the wrong problem, the wrong customer segment, the product's not good enough. Like what's the core issue?
Sure. And it sounds like you're talking to people kind of face to face or on the phone or on a video call about this kind of stuff.
I do face to face whenever possible, because a lot of there's two main reasons. One is that if you do a call with people, they're very outcome focused and they're trying to end the call. So they're like, give me the pitch. Yes, no, send me a proposal. I'll get back to you. They're like, it's really hard to do open-ended learning from someone on a call, either video or phone. Whereas in person, you have these little windows of a few minutes of small talk or like walking to and from the meeting room or like waiting in the queue for your coffee. And those little in-between times are actually where you get the best learning, because the defenses are down. You're not in a sales mode and you can just chat. You're like, hey, this seems like a huge problem for you guys. Like what else have you tried to deal with it? And if you ask that in like a formal setting, they're going to be very defensive and hold their cards close to their chest. But if you can catch these little in-between times, Or if you can meet them in a casual context, like I never rank my customers by their profitability. I always rank them by their friendliness and accessibility. And I almost always start my learning with the friendliest ones. So out of 10 potential customers, is there one who will meet me in the pub for a beer just to chat? If so, I'm definitely starting with that person because like I'm going to get all of this open-ended learning that would be very difficult to get in a more formal context. And you obviously can't bring every customer to the pub, but like, can you bring one? Can you bring two? Can you bring them to a cafe instead of an office? Like that stuff really, really helps with this early learning. And then you transition into formal sales mode once you're like, okay, I know how this works. I know what the budgets are. I know what I'm pitching. It's like that comes later. But at first, it's like people try to be too formal too soon.
Sure. Yeah, I see that a lot. I think you can get away with maybe, I can do maybe three customer interviews in a pub before I start to slur. I think that's the barrier for me. So, I mean, obviously, I'm going to ask the question anyway, even though I know the answer, just so I can get it kind of out of your mouth. Because a lot of people, they've been through the book and they read this and they said, look, I really like the idea of, you know, talking to people and understanding what they're doing and not asking questions about the future and stuff. But this takes a long time. It's not very scalable. Is there any way I can get away with doing this via email or via a survey?
So if it's possible to write it in a survey question, then it already exists as industry research and you're wasting your time by doing a survey. You should just be Googling for the existing industry research. Like I talked to a dude who was building an app to help people learn instruments and he like surveyed 10,000 people to figure out which instrument they wanted to learn. And it was like, dude, what a waste of time. Like that information is definitely available already on Google. Like you should never do customer learning for something you could have Googled. What you're interested in doing customer conversations for is the things you can only get from conversations that you can't get from Google. So like Google can't tell you the emotional reason why an industry tends to pick one product over another. They can't tell you like people's fears, their goals, their insecurities. So that's what you're looking for in your customer conversations. It's this very human like why element. It's emotional. And once you realize that, if you believe that, then you're like, oh, well, I can't do a survey because a survey can't ask those types of questions. And anything I can get on a survey, I can get more easily from Google. In terms of the time cost, there's a couple ways to think about it. One is that it's worth it, and you don't need to have that many conversations. So if you have five conversations, yes, admittedly, that takes 20 hours because you need to do the calendar dance, set them up. Like it takes a little bit of hustling to get people to agree. You commute, you take notes, you share the notes with your team. I agree, it's a pain. But those five conversations, so say a 20-hour cost, can easily save you a product iteration, which is like a three-month cost. So you're turning 20 hours of your time into 3 months of your whole team's time. It's like massively profitable. Once I realized this as an engineer, I was like, oh, wow, I am never building anything until I've talked to customers because otherwise I'm just guaranteed to be wasting my engineering resources. I want a sanity check. I'm like too often wrong. I'm too skeptical of my own intuition. And then the other approach is to find ways to reduce the time cost, which requires being clever, so people tend not to do it. But if you sit down and you go like, okay, who are we trying to talk to? Is there a way to bring more of them into the room without all of the overhead of meetings? Or like, do they already exist in a room and I can go to them? Like if you're serving some industry of small businesses, they all have networking lunches. You can just go to a networking lunch and almost everyone will be pitching their service because they're basically there to look for people to sell to. But if you go and you just like listen to their pitches politely, and then you go, hey, weird question, how do you guys deal with email security? It's been really killing me. Boom, that's a perfect customer conversation. And you can have that like 10 or 20 times over the course of the lunch and learn exactly what you need without having to set up a bunch of individual meetings. So I do so much of that. Like if you go to an industry event and you're pitching, you're wasting such a big opportunity. But if you go there and you're learning by just asking a few good questions, not trying to set up meetings, you're already in the meeting. Like just ask them the question.
Right. I think that kind of leads on into, I guess what my gut feeling is that a lot of the founders who are trying to move towards doing stuff via email or survey, I think part of it is not just the scalability. I think what they're really worried about is, you know, they're scared of doing sales or talking to people. They don't really enjoy it. Do you have any kind of anything you've, any trick or any way you've seen of making it more fun?
Yeah, so I hated it. And I still hate it. I don't want to sell crap to people. But what I realized is two things. So one, the early conversations are not a sales conversation. They're a conversation. It's like talking to a friend and understanding them. like your friend's like, oh man, like work sucks so bad. My boss is driving me crazy. You're not going to be like, have I got a solution for you? You're going to be like, oh, like, tell me more about that. Why is that such an issue? Like, why haven't you done something about it? What else have you tried? I mean, slightly less sociopathically than that, but like, you're going to ask this series of follow-up questions to understand your friend's pain and problem. That's like how friendships work. And that's the same way. It's a conversation. Like, it's not an interview. It's not a sales pitch. And you can do the same thing in your industry. You go to a meetup or you bump into someone or you're having a coffee and you're just like, wow, that seems like a huge problem. Tell me more about it. Boom, it's a conversation. It's valuable for them because people enjoy like thinking through and talking through their problems. Now, and this is where people get stuck. Like if you email someone and go, hey, I just want to have a coffee to talk about your problems. They're going to say no. That seems like a very low value offer from their perspective. They're like, what? Is this person trying to sell something to me? I don't get it. Whereas if you're in a position where you're already having a conversation because you're having a coffee for other reasons, because it's the small talk before or after a pitch, because you're at an event, then like that sort of thing's incredibly natural. And that's not scary at all. That's enjoyable. It's like, oh, wait, I now have a conversation opener. I can like work the room and not feel awkward. This is great. I'm just saying hey to people and they enjoy it. And one trick is to go to the person who looks most uncomfortable to be there, who's like standing by themselves in the corner, because they're going to be desperately grateful that you gave them someone to talk to and something to talk about. And then secondly, once you get to the sales stage, by the time you get to the sales stage, you should know that people really care about what you're selling them. Like if they don't really care, then you're selling garbage and you shouldn't. Like you shouldn't move forward with a product until you're sure that people really care. And at that point, it's like, it's nice to tell them about it. Like if someone's on fire and you have water, you wouldn't feel like an asshole for being like, hey, I got some water. You want it? Like you have the solution to their problem. And the same becomes true for your products. You're like, oh wow, like this person's work life is miserable and I have the solution. Like, let me tell them about it. You're not trying to trick them. You're not trying to convince them. It's just like, hey, this thing exists. And they're like, wow, thank goodness. Why hasn't this existed for years? I want this. So yeah, it's like, I thought it was sleazy. I thought sales, like my techie bias, I thought sales was about tricking people to buy crap they don't need and don't want. But it's not. That's bad sales. And that's bad product design. Like, you know, ensure they really care, build an amazing product, and then just like tell people about it. And at that point, it's really fun.
Sure. Yeah, I guess that makes a lot of sense. I suppose what you want to be is in that kind of position where you're in a conversation with someone and you get to a point where it would feel rude if you didn't offer to let them buy your product.
Sense. Yeah, they're like, oh, I'm hurting, and you're like just hiding your painkillers. You're like, I don't want to pitch anything. I don't want to pitch these painkillers to this person who's bleeding out on the table.
Sure, exactly.
And something else I'll mention is like sometimes you have to step backwards or even kill products because you realize people don't care enough. And like sometimes you can like push and get that first sale and you get 10 grand in your pocket or whatever, but then you're stuck trying to support and sell a product that people don't really want, and that sucks. Much better to realize that they don't care that much and be like, okay, let me go back to the drawing board. How can I change things to make it? Like, I've published 2 books so far, but I've written 8, and 6 of them, I wrote like them to the point where I was testing them with beta readers or like 3 drafts or 4 drafts. Like I spent serious months on them and I was just like, you know what? This isn't good enough. And I like didn't release it, you know, cause I was like, I don't want to be selling this crap. It's like not a book I'm proud of. It's not a book people are going to recommend to their friends. It's like, I don't want a job as a marketer or a salesperson of a mediocre product. So I just killed them. And you have to be willing to do that with your projects as well. Mostly you kill them by like iterating. You kill that version and you go back and you try to make it better. But you know, sometimes you got to take a step backwards.
Right. Yeah. And that's something I love about the mom test. It helps founders, I think, in my opinion, it helps them to get into that position where even if their first product or one of their products does fail, they end up in a position where they've discovered why it failed and they normally have something better that they can work on. Whereas what I really hate to see is founders who spend 6 months working on something, their business fails and they've learned nothing basically. They have, you know, they're back to step zero.
I hate to see like, also, it's not like you're not giving up on the business. When you run into a problem, you're not like, oh, better go home. Like there goes my dreams. You're going like, oh, I discovered one dead end. Let me backtrack slightly and try another route. Because like you still want to get to your destination. The destination is still valid. You're just like, you put your headlights on so that you can see the junk that's in the road. And if the road's blocked, you don't like try to drive through it and you don't go home. You just go, oh, let me reverse a little and find another way around. So that's like the attitude you want to take toward like air quote failure. It's not, you know, it's just like, oh, I'll try something, try a different version.
Sure. I think a lot of people listening to this will be struggling. They'll be wondering if they're in the situation where they should be, you know, changing something, maybe giving up on their idea and trying to work on something else. How would you go about kind of noticing whether that's the case, whether you're in that position?
Talk to entrepreneur buddies who are at the same or slightly ahead of you, but with a different skill set, because they might spot major problems that you're blind to. So for example, there was a dude on Indie Hackers and he's like, you know, here's my product, great product, brilliantly designed, solved a good problem. He's like, here's my marketing. He was driving lots of traffic. He's like, no one's buying it though. I guess they don't want the product. And, you know, poking around, I was like, oh no, they're not buying it because your landing page is incoherent. Like, it doesn't say what it is. It doesn't explain what the product is. It takes like 20 minutes to figure out what you're trying to sell them. Like, of course it's not converting. And just, he was so like product and marketing focused that he was blind to this like big issue somewhere in his flow. So if you can kind of open your books to other entrepreneurs, maybe they'll spot some of these areas that you're just overlooking and you go, oh wow, yeah, I can fix that. Like, it's the unknown unknowns, I think, is an important thing. And so before I shut anything down, I'd want to be like, you know, bounce it off a few people and be like, hey, if you were in my shoes, what would you do with this? And phrase that way. It's not like, hey, do you think this is good or bad? They'll never tell you the truth if you put your ego on the line like that. But if you go, hey, if this was your thing, what would you try next? You know, sometimes you can spot some problems you weren't aware of and get some easy wins.
Sure. What do you think about landing pages? Because I've got to be honest, I'm not a big fan of them in the early stage. I think the way I kind of see them is, you know, as a developer, you wouldn't spend all day coding without a break and then at the end of the day, deploy and see if it works or not. You know, you take it kind of step by step and, you know, kind of line by line and make sure the first thing works and the second thing and then the third thing. And it feels to me like a landing page in a lot of cases is saying, okay, you know, I have to get the value proposition right. I have to be showing it to the right people. I have to be handling all the right objections. And if I get any one thing wrong, then it'll result in a, you know, a no sale. It won't be successful, but I won't have really learned anything apart from that something there is wrong. So when do you think people should be going into landing pages?
So I would never do a landing page as my like first MVP, because as you say, it doesn't really prove anything. It can tell you that like you got everything correct and it's working brilliantly, but if it's not, it like can't tell you why it's not working. So yeah, I agree completely. But like, if you're building a marketing driven product, at some point you need a website that says what it does. And that's all I meant by that. But one of the nice things about sales, like especially techie people, you know, like myself, like we fear sales because we go, oh, this is terrible. It's so much more work. I have to line up meetings. I wish I was on the internet right now. But the incredible benefit of sales is that you get much better feedback and insight into what's not working. Like, if no one will take a meeting with you, then it's almost certainly either your problem or your email etiquette. Like, if people take a meeting, but they won't take a second meeting, like it's almost certainly that like your pitch or your product features aren't like up to snuff. There's like a series of like debug. It's much easier to debug what's going wrong in a sales process, because you get like, you know, you're exposed to the customer. You can see where they become disinterested. You can see what puts them off. So it's great. And then that feeds directly back into your engineering and you can get a better product much faster with a sales loop than you can with a marketing loop.
Right. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Now, we don't have a lot of time left, but there are a couple of questions I wanted to ask to make sure we get in. And one of them is, you know, I noticed it's been a couple of years since you wrote the Montest. And if I think
six,
if I think back to, you know, to me 6 years ago, you know, I've changed my mind on a lot of things. I've you know, I've hopefully learned a lot more. Is there anything looking back now at the Montest that you think, well, if I was writing this today, I would phrase this slightly differently, or I would put more emphasis on that?
Yeah. I mean, there must be, there's a ton of little things. Overall though, the book works surprisingly well, for what it does. I'm like, I reread it recently when I was doing the audiobook and I was like, yeah, this holds up like much better than I thought it would have. So the book itself, I'm pretty happy. I think it's like, there's a few like more sophisticated tricks that people can add on, and people are gradually writing like extra blog posts and books, which kind of build on the foundation of the Montest, which I think is great. But the biggest thing that's changed for me in my view in like business and entrepreneurship is I used to think the idea didn't matter at all. I think this comes out of like being too far in the lean startup world, which I definitely was. And I was like, the idea doesn't matter. You can't predict the future. All that matters is execution and learning. So what happened was I started choosing really dumb ideas to work on. And no surprise, they didn't work. Or they would work, but it would still be insufficient to pay my bills, which is even more heartbreaking. And what I've learned is that like you can't predict whether or not a business is going to work or not. Like obviously you're dealing with risk and uncertainty, but you can predict a ton of stuff about like the shape of the idea. So like if it's kind of working, like what's it going to feel like to run? Like, do you have to do 24-hour customer support? Like how big is your team going to need to be? Like, are you going to need to have an office or can you work remotely? What sort of people are you going to need to hire? Are they tech people or salespeople? Like, is it an all or nothing business where you either get super rich or you don't get anything, or can you like take it incrementally? And once I realized all that, I was like, oh wow, I can be so much choosier about my ideas. And my success rate on projects went from like close to zero to close to 100% just by changing my approach to idea selection. And also my businesses started making me happy, because for the first, like I've been doing startups for 12 years now. I'd say the first 5 years, I did it because I felt I couldn't do anything else. I like had to do it, but they made me miserable. It was like suffering. It was like martyrdom to do entrepreneurship. And then once I realized I could just pick ideas which were easy and made me happy, I was like, oh, this is great. My whole life changed. So I think idea selection still really, really matters.
Brilliant. And leading on from that, it takes me exactly where I wanted to go next, which is motivation. I think a big, you know, two of the big killers that I see of kind of startups or founder projects is motivation, or losing motivation and losing momentum. Have you had any kind of experience in how to keep momentum and motivation high as you kind of, you know, you're in that first kind of excited phase when you just have the idea, when you've talked to a few people, and then suddenly reality hits you when you talk to a few more? You know, how do you keep motivation up over 6 months, over a year, over even longer?
So I've got the worst follow through of all time. I think this is one of the like reasons I'm deeply unsuited for scalable startups. I just can't keep doing a hard thing for many years. So what I try to do is I try to pick ideas that are going to be easy and fun for me. And then I try to create a context around myself where it's easy to stay excited. So with books, for example, like I love the first draft and I hate editing. You know, I like the creative brain dumping stage. So I'm like, okay, like, so how do I arrange my time? Like part of why I built a team was because I wanted the social pressure to prevent me from quitting projects before they were finished. Cause like I would do the first half when it was fun, but then I wouldn't do the second half. So I'm like, okay, well now I have people whose salaries I need to pay. And obviously don't rush into that, cause that's a responsibility and a risk, but it's like, it's been really helpful cause now I like have to do the work I don't want to do. So that's part of it. And part of it's just like making your life easy. Like if you don't want to be doing lots of marketing and like blog posting and all of that, then like don't pick an idea which depends on building a list to work. Like, you know, like you can pick ideas that allow you to do the activities that you're going to find easy to do. Like any day, I find it the easiest thing in the world to wake up and write for 4 hours. I find it the hardest thing in the world to wake up and do 10 minutes of taxes. You know, so if I'm choosing an idea, I'm going to try to choose an idea that lets me do the stuff that I find easy and fun, rather than the stuff that's an absolute grind. That's all I got. What do you think? You're probably much better at this ongoing hustle than I am.
Oh, I don't know. when it comes to motivation, I think one thing I would say, just from talking to a lot of founders about kind of struggling through this, is that, you know, I'm a technical founder as well, and we tend to focus on the problem a lot. So we tend to get really excited about, you know, this kind of defined problem set that we can solve. And there will be a solution, and we're trying to work towards an optimum solution. And the thing is, like, the, solving that problem may not actually turn out to be the best way of kind of helping the customer create, like, create value for them and solving their pain. So they'll kind of be pulling away. And, you know, if you're really interested in this problem, that's what's got you excited, you know, building an app or whatever it is to solve that problem, and it turns out that that's not really the problem that needs solving after all, then it's really easy to get kind of disheartened and demotivated. Whereas if right. you focus much more on the customer and helping them, and you get your motivation from, you know, helping that customer and, you know, helping people and creating value in their life, then kind of the motivation's in the right place. So even when you're doing something, you know, when you realize that you're not going to get to build the cool app and you have to start writing blog posts instead, then you'll still be more likely to be motivated. I think that's something I've seen work reasonably well for founders.
Yeah, I could see that. And something else I'd add is, and this is like unpopular advice or advice that maybe doesn't get given enough, is like it's okay to be extremely selfish with your selection of idea. Like choose. So for example, I don't care about social impact at all. Not one bit. I just don't care. Right. People go, oh, you got to change the world. I'm like, no, I do not.
That's going to be the
like, you can change the world if you want to, but like that does not get me out of bed in the morning. I don't care at all. Similarly, I don't care at all about scale. People go, yeah, but like $1 billion. Don't care at all. I want to like play video games and drink beers with my friends. It's like not an expensive lifestyle. You know, I don't need $1 billion to do that. And so once I realized that like what I want is leisure time, and for a few years of my life, I really wanted the location independence. So like all of my business efforts went into getting location independence, and I had it and I really enjoyed it for a few years. And then I was like, okay, that was fun, but I want to settle down now. And then all of my efforts went into like, I want all my time to myself. So all my efforts went into passive income. And for me, I'm much more motivated and I find it easier to work toward completely selfish lifestyle goals. And that's fine. And I ended up like making the mom test, which has been helpful for a lot of people. So I've kind of accidentally had an impact, which is great. But I'd say like, if you can be really honest about what selfishly motivates you and like not be ashamed about that or compare it to Elon Musk or whoever, then I think it's much, much easier.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, you're going to be subconsciously pulled towards that anyway, right? So you may as well kind of embrace it and realize that's happening. I think if you, you know, if you think that you do want to run a, you know, a massive kind of VC backed unicorn startup, then you know, just go and spend a couple of months working closely with the founder of one of those companies who's taken, you know, 15, 20 million or more. And I guarantee that for 99.9% of you, you will not want to be doing that job once you've spent a week kind of seeing their calendar and the stuff they have to do. It is not fun. It's a very, very weird subset of people who can kind of thrive on doing that job. And I'm definitely not one of them. I don't want to take up any more of your time. This has been really useful and I've really enjoyed it. Where can people go and find out more about you, find the mom test, find some of the other stuff that you've been writing? Obviously, it goes without saying, you know, I really recommend the mom test to anybody who is, you know, you don't even have to be an early stage founder. I'd say it'd be really useful for marketing and sales teams as well. Even for product teams, if, you know, in a kind of, if you're in a more product, you know, in a more kind of user customer facing role, where can people go and find out more about that?
RobFitz.com has links to the books and everything else. And so there's the mom test book and there's also the workshop survival guide, which is more about running workshops and teaching. So if that's part of your, you know, your cash flow strategy or something you find yourself doing, you might find that book useful too.
Awesome. Then thanks a lot, Rob. It's been great to have you on and look forward to seeing your new book when it comes out.
Thank you for having me and good luck on the businesses, everybody.
That's all for this week's episode of the Sales for Founders podcast. If you're struggling to find your first customers or to grow a profitable business, why not head on over to salesforfounders.com, where you can get on the early bird waitlist for the Sales for Founders course, and you'll learn everything you need to know about sales to go from zero to $10,000 in monthly revenue. There'll be actionable lessons from people like myself, last week's guest Laura, and today's guest Rob. And if you enjoyed the podcast, it would be awesome if you helped other people just like you to find it by leaving a quick 5-star review in your podcast. Thanks, and see you next Wednesday.